rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. I'm Tom Hartman, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and CRN Digital on cable systems in 29 states. Welcome back to our program. Guy James, an old friend of mine, a guy who does some great radio out of Florida. Guy James spent the weekend with Cindy Sheehan in Crawford, Texas. Hey, Guy.
Good afternoon, Tom. It's afternoon here. I guess it's good morning where you're at.
Well, it's we have people listening all around the country. So, in fact,
sure.
We've got a couple of folks in our chat room from Europe. So I guess it's
definitely good
afternoon there. So anyhow, Guy, first of all, how can people find out more about your program?
Well,
Guy James Show.
Just go to our good old website, www.theguyjamesshow.com, and I'll tell you all you need to know. We're on Saturdays. We're in the heart of darkness down here in Florida, in hardcore conservative country. So we get out shouted, but we don't get outworked. So.
But you keep on keeping on.
That's right.
And you have for many, many years.
You
know, everybody talks like progressive talk radio is this brand new thing. I'm sorry, it's not.
No.
It's a marvelous thing, and it's great that Air America's there and all these other folks that are doing wonderful work. But guys like you and me have been doing this for, you've been doing a lot longer than I have.
Well, we've been doing radio a long, long time, and it's good to see that a lot of progressive and liberals are getting a chance now, having to burrow their way through it, but we'll get there.
Yeah, there you go. So, Crawford, Texas. First of all, how's Cindy doing?
Cindy's doing great. Cindy looks like she's holding up very, very well. She's a very, very strong woman, and she's just got a wonderful gleam in her eye, and is so happy with the results of what's happening out there, the way that she's been received by so many thousands of people across the country, and millions who are keeping track of this whole situation. She's buoyed by that, I'm sure.
Yeah, this has got to be a tough time in her life. I know she's got some, you know, as Matt Drudge has so enthusiastically dragged out for the American people, she's got a few family members who are opposed to what she's doing, which, welcome to the family.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I think we all have family members who disagree with what we're doing. It's probably a good thing, actually. It's the diversity within a family. And, you know, but it's got and she lost her son. I mean, that's the kind of thing that destroys marriages, that destroys lives.
You bet it is. It's an upheaval in a family. And many times it's irreparable harm. It's been done.
So I'm curious. We've had a couple of our truckers on Sirius Satellite Radio. In fact, last week, one of them called in and said he was going to stop at the sheriff's office. And then during the break, he called in and said he went in and he talked with the sheriff. And they were actually very nice to him. They showed him where to put his rig and stuff. And what was your experience with the local authorities in Crawford?
Well, the local authorities, I found the city police to be very accommodating and very nice gentlemen. I talked to a couple of the county, I forget the name of the county, but I talked to a couple of the county people. They were very firm and, you know, they're not approving of what's going on there. There's no question about that. They're having to make the best of it, and they know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's probably costing them money. I mean, they probably have to put in overtime and whatnot.
Sure. Sure it is.
Yeah. You know, welcome to American democracy. You know, what can you say? I mean, George Bush decided to buy his hobby farm there, and his so-called ranch is 1,600 acres, which is, what, 4 square miles? Must be.
Yeah, that's quite a bit, almost 4 square miles.
Yes.
It's in a remote area, very remote area, down this windy road, his farm is actually on a public road, but they've got it barricaded. We stopped and spoke to the Secret Service people for a while. Of course, they're very tight-lipped and wouldn't tell us anything about his comings and goings and so forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, if people don't think Cindy's had somewhat of an effect, Mr. Bush and his group had to go past her on Friday to go to that God knows how many $1,000 plate barbecue.
They
right
raised $2 million that night.
Yeah, and at the Broken Arrow Ranch, I think is the name of it, or Crooked Arrow or something.
Yes.
And we found out that he was going to be at this little league softball or baseball game, and they flew him by helicopter, that so he wouldn't have to pass Cindy again.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It's
so what's it like in the town of Crawford?
Well, with apologies to all of my progressive and liberal friends who are Texans and perhaps even live in Crawford, Texas, I'm not sure. For the most part, it's not exactly an intellectual stronghold. I've found some of the worst bigoted, racist, redneck attitude that I think I've ever seen.
For example?
The pickup truck cadre, you know, driving around town with the big flag poles in the back, with their big flags and, you know, yelling obscenities at the very, very peaceful people that were there at the vigil. I saw nothing untoward whatsoever with the people in defense of Cindy, but the other side got very loud, very vocal, very, very angry and nasty. I would be surprised if this thing goes on very long and there's not some sort of an incident because those people are extremely angry. Oddly enough, we're the ones that are accused of being so angry these days. And I would submit if you're not angry at what's going on in this government right now, you're just not an American. That's all there is to it. But the locals there very, very much, very vehemently oppose the people coming in from out of town and supporting Cindy.
Did you patronize a local restaurant?
Yes, I did. I went in the local restaurant, and of course they had the life-size cutouts, so the obligatory life-size cutouts of the bushes all over the place. And I sat down and ordered a chef salad, and I think that's what gave me away is not being one of the locals. And
what's a chef?
Yeah.
Or what's
a
chef salad?
yeah, that's right. They didn't. You know, everybody was eating fried whatever, and. You know, the comments started in. They knew that I wasn't one of them, and I ate part of my salad and left. I didn't want to cause an incident of any kind.
The comments started. What do you mean? You're sitting there, and people around are
yeah, he can hear
talking
me
at you.
Table. I suppose he's one of those SOBs from one of those commie socialists. You know the rhetoric they use, and you can just hear it. And so I. Rather than cause an incident, because I'm not the type of guy that takes that very well, so I figured I'd better get out of there, or I would stand up and say something I might regret. I don't know.
Yeah. And in that particular situation, there was more of them than there were of you.
Oh, yes. Quite a few.
So the Crawford Peace House, crawfordpeacehouse.org, by the way, is their website. I went to their website this weekend and made a donation. I understand that they were in dire straits before all this started, and things have changed somewhat.
Oh, they have. They've got mountains of supplies in. Money is being donated. A wonderful group down there. I don't know how they do it. They're trying to keep orderly in what is, by its very nature, a very unorderly process. And they're doing a remarkable job of it. The gals in the office, Bridget, and they're all doing it with a smile. They're having to direct traffic out front because the local authorities don't want cars parking on the road and so forth. It's a logistics nightmare, but they are making the best of it. And some of these folks are veterans of this type of thing, and they know how to handle it.
Well, I'm curious. There's on the one hand, you've got Cindy and the folks down there saying, "Come on down to Crawford." But on the other hand, Crawford's this little town in the middle of nowhere. Where do you stay? The public streets, you can't clog them up. The private property is by and large owned by, local yahoos who are in love with or beholden to the bushes, or the local power structure that certainly is in with the bushes. So
There's no place to go. There's a little town named McGregor not far away. But I'll just tell you a short story. I was using what we call in the business a Comrex unit to broadcast back home to my home station.
You did your show live from there on Saturday.
Yes. Yeah. And we kept getting knocked off because of technical problems. And so before that, I had gone almost door to door. How foolish is this? Gone door to door up and down the street asking if I could rent somebody's phone line for the day.
Hmm.
And I got no cooperation. And so I called down at McGregor at the motel in McGregor and asked if I could rent a room to use a phone line. They wanted to know what for. And of course they ditched that. So you're pretty much out of luck as far as staying around there. You're 25 miles away from Waco, I think it is, and there are places to stay there.
Well, that's not far. Waco's a pretty good sized town.
Yeah, it is. It's a good sized town.
Yeah, I flew over it. Actually, we landed there once when back 25, 30 years ago when I used to fly little airplanes. So what's your advice for anybody who might be thinking about going down to Crawford? Because I don't want to discourage people from going down there with the kind of negative picture you portrayed, because to some extent the success of what they're doing depends on people showing up. But we also need people to show up in a way that is going to contribute to some positive outcome rather than just to general chaos. What's your advice?
Well, don't go there expecting to get a bunch of personal service of any kind, because you're not going to. Be prepared out at the site, out at the vigil, out on the Prairie Road, whatever, Prairie Chapel Road. Be prepared for rather primitive conditions. You know, take some bug spray. Be ready for very primitive conditions, because that's what exists, and there's not a whole lot of facilities available in town. People are taking water and toilet paper. I'd say that's the two most essential things. And Tom, one thing I do want to tell everybody to be ready for is when you drive around a few curves and get close to the site, be ready for the sight of those 1,800 crosses, so very neatly and proudly displayed in the ditch. In a long, long row, the sight of that is, it'll take your breath away, believe me.
That's 1,800, it's hard to imagine, 1,800 human beings.
For nothing.
It's not entirely for nothing, Guy. It did help the Republicans take the Senate back in 2002.
Well, yeah.
It helped George to get reelected in 2004, and back in 1999, you know, he told his biographer, the guy who wrote his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, that if he got elected and he had a chance to invade Iraq, he would not make the mistake his father did and squander that political capital. He would end the war early. He would use that political capital to get his programs done, to undo the New Deal and roll back, destroy Social Security and get Republicans elected. And he successfully did that.
Well, and those 1,800 very precious young men and women ended up being the spare change in the whole thing out of his political capital, and that's a crime indeed.
Yeah, it is. So what are the best things that people can do, those of us who can't show up in Crawford, Texas? What are the best things?
Get on their website and send them money. It costs a lot of money to keep that outfit going down there.
Is this the Crawford Peace House? Is that
yes,
the best place?
Yes.
So that's crawfordpeacehouse.org.
Yeah, and they've got a place where you can use PayPal on there.
And that's what I did. And I, even if you just give them $10, I mean, it all adds up if a lot of people toss
you
the money.
You bet it does. And they're conserving the money. They're using it wisely. There's no extravagance going on there, believe me.
Yeah. And Cindy's holding up, and she's not going off into la-la land of I'm a star or any of that kind of thing.
Oh, very well. She's an incredibly strong woman. And I started out my program the other day by saying they talk about George Bush being the most important person in Crawford, Texas. He is not. Cindy Sheehan most definitely is right now.
There you go. Guy James, theguyjamesshow.com, his website. Guy, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I appreciate it, and good on you for showing up in Crawford, Texas, and doing your show live from the Peace House there on Saturday. Quite a feat. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In my ears. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, from outside the United States, 503-248-0620. TomHartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. This Kathleen Parker, a right-wing columnist, had a piece published in the local paper here today in Oregon, but it's nationally syndicated, and I'm assuming it's probably in every paper in America. Somebody got behind this thing and really pushed it hard. And it says George Bush can't meet with Cindy Sheehan because... he really wants to, she says, but regardless of what he might personally wish to do, he has responsibilities far exceeding the crowd gathering beyond his Prairie Chapel Ranch. I mean, I remember when Richard Nixon went out at night to the Washington Memorial and met, was it the Washington Memorial or the Lincoln Memorial? It was one of them, there in Washington, D.C., and met with a bunch of the protesters against the Vietnam War. And it seemed that he was having a real crisis of conscience at that time. But George Bush, now, you can't have a crisis of conscience if you don't have a conscience. Anyhow, Kathleen Parker, she says, if he allowed himself to be photographed with Cindy Sheehan, and I quote, "Democrats might be delighted to freeze that image in political time, but so would insurgents planning their next Baghdad ambush." You get this? If Bush meets with Cindy Sheehan in Crawford, Texas, and tells her what the noble cause is for which her son died, which is the question she's asking him, and tells her why his daughters, who are unemployed but of military age, are not joining the military and volunteering for Iraqi service, the other question she was asking him, if he simply meets with her and tells her those two things, the insurgents in Baghdad are going to be so pleased. Yeah. Yeah. Just a few things, you know, just to kind of catch up on the news of the day. George Bush, speaking on Israeli television over the weekend, said that all options are on the table with regard to Iran, as in, let's drop bombs on them. I'm really continue to be astounded by how little coverage, how little press coverage has been devoted to the fact that Iran and Iraq have signed a contract to allow Iran to invest $1 billion in rebuilding Iraq, and that they have signed a mutual defense agreement. If we attack Iraq, if we attack Iran, we may have Iraq declaring war on us. I mean, you know, like in World War One, you know, you attack my the people, we've got to, so we now we have to. It's just very, very strange. Very strange. So, you know, I think it's really important to keep track of these things and note what's going on. The other thing, the deadline was apparently missed this morning for the Constitution. We'll keep you up to date on that. But the two of the major issues with regard to the Constitution are, number one, is Sharia law. Is the Quran going to be considered the source or a source of Iraqi law? This is really important, because if it's the source, then immediately women will not be allowed to vote. They're going to have to go back under the veil. Men will not be allowed to get haircuts or beard cuts. Alcohol will be banned countrywide, all these kinds of things. And they'll be like Saudi Arabia every Friday, cutting people's heads and feet and hands off in the public square. If it's a source, it'll be more like, you know, I believe it's Jordan where it's a source. It's, you know, they will have some influence. That's one. And the other is the issue of federalism. Should they have a government like the United States does, where you have a federal government and you have state governments, with the risk that they might re-experience what we did with the Civil War, and some of those states will say, like the Sunni states in the center or the Kurdish states in the north, will say, hey, that's it, we're taking off, we're going to secede, and thus lead to a civil war. Should they have a federal government, or should they simply have a central government without states that have autonomous power, and the entire country is run out of Baghdad, no matter how remote from Baghdad it may be? And there's strong arguments on both sides, by the way, regardless of your position on Iraq. There's strong arguments on both sides. Tough stuff. They got to work it out. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
What if a guy came up to you and said, I'm going to bring forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal? You'd probably say, right on, good luck with that. And what if he said, I'm going to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity? You'd probably say, wow, knock yourself out. And what if he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. You'd probably say, I got a meeting.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 26 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Braswell in Augusta, Georgia. He's the guy who, the trucker who called us back with the report about the sheriff there in Crawford. Hey, Braswell.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. So tell us what happened when you dropped by Crawford yesterday, or on Friday.
Oh, we had a good time out there. I met a lot of people. I met the two people that inspired me to go there, Mona and Barbara, the mm-hmm. ones that came from California.
Mm-hmm.
I met them out there. We met with the Veterans for Peace.
Right.
And we had a real good time. Then, we had somebody, a representative, came out from Martin Luther King Jr. Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what, I learned a lot more from your show than I thought I did. And we got out there, they started getting insight from the people that was around and what we think we ought to do.
Yeah.
And it came up from a couple of people that we ought to get John Kerry and some big name Democrats out there.
Yeah, I understand Maxine Waters was out there over the weekend.
Yeah, so I told him, I said, I think that what you're doing right now is small name people that is getting out more and is making a bigger impact with small names than, you're going to turn it political if you start getting big name Democrats out there. So
yeah, I think you're right.
We had, they gave a piece, what do you do in hostile situations classes, and we had all kind of stuff we was doing out there. We talked to a lot of newspaper reporters, Time, Jet, Ebony, it was CNN. It was a whole bunch of people out there taking interviews, and I took pictures with
her
name, nah.
So Brad, that's okay, Braswell. So you'd recommend to the other truckers listening that they drop by?
Say it again, huh?
So would you recommend to the other truckers listening who might be in the area of Crawford, Texas, that they drop by and say hi and lend their support?
Oh, yeah. Shoot, I had a good time. Like I said, the sheriff department told me where to park at. I parked right beside the bank.
Mm-hmm.
That's right beside the hoop house.
That's where you put your rig? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I took a shuttle from there, and they brought me back when I got ready to come back. And, they give you food and drink. You don't have to worry about anything.
That's great.
They take care of everything out there.
That's great. Braswell, thanks a lot for the update.
Okay.
Thanks for giving us a shout and keeping us up to date on that. And thanks for listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Dale in Westchester, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Dale, what's on your mind today?
Well, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the show. Several of us are lobbying today for House Bill 550 that's put forward by Rush Holt to actually have a better system where people trust their voting system and those that count the votes. And on a related subject, because I got to go, over the weekend, CommonDreams.org had a really interesting article about a lot more evidence of voter fraud in Florida, where several counties allegedly had 200-300% of registered Republicans vote.
Yeah.
I was curious if you got to investigate that.
I did. I read the article. I mean, I didn't do the primary investigation kind of stuff like I have on some of the voter fraud articles that I was writing 2 and 3 years ago. But it makes, from what I understand of the situation and what I've read and the people that I know who are on the ground who are working on vote fraud issues, the article seemed pretty stand-up, pretty solid. Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind that the vote for the last 6 years that there has been substantial voter fraud and manipulation. Frankly, there's no doubt in my mind that for the last 200 years there's been voter fraud and manipulation in various places around this country by various people. I mean, it's just, welcome to the wonderful world of human nature and politics. But, to the extent that but now the Republicans have turned it into an art form. I mean, they have just elevated this thing from an occasional thing here and there into an absolute art form. And it's not a good thing for democracy at all. I have to tell you, Dale, I have some concerns about Rush Holt's bill, because Rush Holt's bill still allows, as does Hillary Clinton's bill, still allows corporations to be counting our vote in secret and telling us how we voted. And even if there's a paper trail, what you find is that in a lot of states where they have done this, for example, Nebraska, right after Chuck Hagel quit his job as president of what is now ES&S and ran for Senate in Nebraska and won in a landslide after he had sold ES&S machines to the state of Nebraska and his vote was counted on his own machines. Right after that, of course, with that election, the Republicans took the Nebraska House and Senate. And right after that, I mean, within months after that, they passed a law saying that you cannot hand count those ballots if the win by the opponent is over a certain percentage. I forget the threshold. I think it was, 2 or 3%. And a lot of states have those rules. Ohio did, for example. This election that we just had where Paul Hackett went up against the woman who won. I'm with the that Paul Hackett election, because he lost by 3%. You had that one county, the county where they had locked down the county in the previous election and said that, you know, Homeland Security told them they had to do it and they couldn't let the reporters watch them count the vote and all that, and it pushed George Bush over the top. That same county, at the very last minute, came in with the vote that pushed Braswell's or Hackett's opponent over the top. And because it pushed it over the top by more than 3%, it's illegal for there to be a recount of the vote, even if there's a paper trail. And so, you know, I'm concerned. Rush Holt's bill does not address that. And I think, frankly, that instead of Rush Holt's bill and Hillary Clinton's bill, which I've been supportive of on this program for the last couple of years, I'm frankly of the opinion that we need to have legislation that simply says private for-profit corporations may not handle or count our vote in any way, period. It has to be done by state agencies answerable to we the people, and it has to be done if computers are used. The computers have to have open source software. It has to be, and the entire process from beginning to end has to be completely transparent and inspectable by we the people. So,
well, thanks so much for that.
Yeah.
And I'll keep it in mind because we're gonna lobby today.
So yeah, I had this discussion with Rush Holt a year and a half ago, and you know, he was talking about, you know, the wonders of his bill, and I was agreeing with him at the time. And then I said, you know, Rush, why do we have corporations involved in the vote at all? And there was like this long pause, and he said, you know, that's a good question. But see, it never got addressed. And so, you know, I think his bill is probably a good first step, although it could ultimately be a bad thing. At least this is what Paul Leto and a lot of people in the, you know, not the verified voting movement, but in the fraud-free voting movement are saying, because it'll cause people to have confidence. It'll cause people to believe that their vote is safe, when in fact it could be that you'd have situations like you have in Ohio where you've got a paper trail. There was a paper trail in that election, but it can't be inspected. And, you know, and all you have to do is just rig the machine so that you get more than a 3% win, and boom, you got, you know, it's as if there was no paper trail. So, you know, please bring those issues up in what you're doing. And, you know, I congratulate you. I salute you for what you're doing. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Blaine in Illinois. Hey, Blaine, what's up?
Hey. I just wanted to call and tell you that, you know, I admire Cindy's tenacity and vigilance out in Crawford, but I'm not sure I understand what she's attempting to accomplish. What concerns me most, I think, is that one person is trying to hold the presidency hostage, and that opens a dangerous floodgate later on down the road. And I think I could probably be more supportive if I really understood what her agenda was, other than to really kind of poke holes at Bush. I mean,
well, her agenda
on every day anyway.
Her agenda, Blaine, is pretty apparent. It's political theater. She's doing the same thing that the Bonus Army marchers did in 1929-1930 when they camped outside the White House and said to President Herbert Hoover that because of the Great Depression, that his policies, his six consecutive massive tax cuts for the wealthy that led to the Great Depression, that his economic policies had thrown them out of work, and therefore he should pay them early the World War I bonus that they had been promised over time. And, you know, they camped out outside the White House, and you had Hoovervilles that were formed all around there. And Hoover's response, Herbert Hoover's response, of course, was to bring Douglas MacArthur in on horseback and Dwight Eisenhower and run them off and burn their village out. And one of the reasons why he lost so badly in the 1932 election. But, you know, we have a long history in the United States of political theater of this kind. And I don't think anybody thinks it's anything more or less than that.
Yeah, I'm a little bit concerned that it may open a dangerous precedent. If one person can hold the presidency hostage, it opens the door for, you know, hundreds of other people with other agendas, less as important as what she's.
Well, how is he being held hostage?
Well, basically, she's saying, I'm going to stay here until you talk to me, and if you leave, I'm going to follow you to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to stay there until you
talk. Yeah, and, well, that's nothing new. I mean, there's been people camped outside the White House forever. There are constantly people protesting. The fact of the matter is that the press is paying attention to Cindy Sheehan, on this right now. But, you know, this too shall pass, I predict, Blaine. But, you know, nobody's holding anybody hostage here. It's a nice phrase from right-wing talk radio, but nobody's holding anybody hostage. Cindy Sheehan is exercising her right. In fact, the founders thought it was so important that in the First Amendment to the Constitution, they actually wrote it into the Constitution that Congress shall make no law that will restrict the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And that's exactly what she's doing. She is assembling, and the people around her, to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And, you know, there's a long history of that kind of political dissent in the United States. I don't expect Bush will meet with her. You know, if I was Bush and if I was one of his advisors, I would suggest to him that, in fact, that he not meet with her because, you know, it's the sort of thing where, you know, if you do one, then who's going to be the next one that you're going to do, you know, quack, quack, quack. Although, frankly, from a PR point of view, if he had met with her early on and he had had an honest conversation with her, you know, it might have been the best thing he could have done PR-wise. But now, you know, it's too much water under the bridge. I think now he would look like he was caving in. So, frankly, I don't think that he can meet with her from a PR point of view, and his advisors will probably advise him against it.
But, oh, absolutely. He's let that fire get way out of control already.
Yeah, but this too shall pass. I mean, we all have to understand that, you know, yes, every citizen has a right to write a letter to the president. No citizen has the right to expect the president to answer that letter or to come out and meet with them. But, you know, on the other hand, every citizen is entitled to peaceably assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances, to stand up and speak out. We have, you know, back in England, before the American experiment started, there was that, was it Trafalgar Square, I believe it was? Hyde Park or what? Anyhow, there was a park where one corner, there was one place where you could stand and you could speak. And that was the only place in the whole country that you could stand and you could speak your mind. And, you know, here in the United States, the entire country is supposed to be a free speech zone, and that's what people do. So, Blaine, thanks for the call. I appreciate you raising it and, you know, raising the issue. Alice in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. two of my favorite people were just talking, and I thank you. If there were any good reasons for us being in Iraq, I think Bush would go out and say it.
Oh, sure. But yeah. But the reason that we're in Iraq, very simply, Alice, is because Bush thought that he would be able to politically capitalize on a short, successful war, just like his father did, only he could do it better than his father did, and he was going to show his father that he could do it better than he did, and he didn't realize what he was getting into. He screwed up. He didn't take the advice of people like General Shinseki or Colin Powell, for that matter, in the early days, who actually knew what war is like.
Yeah, well, so, he thought he knew it all.
Yeah, and time has proven that he didn't, tragically, in terms of blood and loss of national treasure.
It's terrible.
Yeah, and you like Guy James, huh, Alice? Alice?
Pardon?
And you said you like Guy James?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
He's
a good
very
man.
Very good.
Yeah, he's a good man. He's got a great program.
Good.
You can hear him on the Internet on Saturday mornings. Alice, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Great to hear from you.
Yeah.
Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was listening to what you were saying there about Nixon. I remember when he met with those protesters. So I guess, like you said, he had somewhat of a conscience, probably more so than this guy. But
he did it quietly and secret in the middle of the night. He didn't call the press with him.
Yeah, and I think his Secret Service people went nuts when he did it. So
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah. In fact, I thought that he had to slip away from them, didn't?
Yeah.
They didn't know he was there. He went there alone.
It was a long time ago, but it's a funny thing about the guy. As bad as he was, you know, he did have his moments. But anyway, someone called last Friday when you had Bernie on, and said I believe they had seen something on the internet about some possible coming indictments in the Bush administration?
Yeah, there have been reports, and they have been, up to this point, confined to those websites that one out of 100 times, or maybe even one out of 10 times, really break really cool stories, and then 9 out of 10 times or 99 out of 100 times, I don't know the percentage, but, you know, really the stories kind of fall into the category of flying saucers have landed. And a couple of those types of websites have been saying that the grand jury that has been impaneled, that Patrick Fitzgerald is prosecuting on behalf of, has actually returned indictments against George Bush, Dick Cheney, and a whole bunch of other members, senior administration members, members of the cabinet. And it's being reported that, you know, the members of the grand jury are not denying. Of course, members of the grand jury don't speak on the record.
Right.
So we really don't have any idea, is the bottom line.
Well, a couple of things about this. Number one, the particular website that I saw was a pretty conservative website. And if I read the story correctly, it was everybody but Bush. It was Cheney. It was Ashcroft. It was actually Karl Rove was supposedly indicted on a separate case of perjury for lying about what he did.
Right.
And it even included Judith Miller, who's already in jail.
Yeah.
So some people.
Yeah,
have
I saw that as well. I've seen three or four different iterations of this, Rick. And the reality is, we will know when we know. Although it's interesting that Bush just reassigned Patrick Fitzgerald's boss to a different job, and his old skull and bones buddy is now going to be Patrick Fitzgerald's boss. So
really.
Yeah. Yeah, that just happened 2 weeks ago. So we will see, although I'm not sure exactly when it takes effect. So we'll see how this all plays out. You know, we live in interesting times, Rick. We live in very interesting times. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some cranky old right-wing think tank or the Heritage Foundation or the Republican National Committee. It's the true free speech zone right here, right now.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzled.
And George did such a marvelous job at that, didn't he, in the 2004 election. He razzled-dazzled us so well. Welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Steve in Oklahoma driving a truck. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, thanks for calling. Yeah, I just want to say to all the Bush supporters out there, if you really think this man's a good president, you really do, all you need to do is just look at the prices at our pumps.
Yeah.
I mean, it is ridiculous. Now, like last week, Tom, I fueled up in Oklahoma City, and it was $2.22. And today, it's $2.42.
And you know what's even more outrageous about that, Steve, is because the Republicans, starting with Reagan, decided to ignore the energy changes in national energy policy that Jimmy Carter tried to put into place, at least half of that money that you're spending on that oil, or about half of it, is going to pay for madrasas where they're training young Muslims to be terrorists.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you say, and it's just, I can't even comprehend it, Tom. I get so frustrated, my mind blocks up, if you get what I'm saying, that this guy is getting away with what he's getting away with, the war.
Yeah.
Oh, my. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Well, I have a feeling, Steve, he's not getting away with it. I have a feeling the American people are waking up and that there's going to be a big change in the 2006 election. And hopefully it'll be so big that even with rigged voting machines and purging African-Americans from voting rolls and all the other little tricks the Republicans have been doing, jamming the phone lines of phone banks and things, still they're going to lose big time.
Yeah, I hope so. And you keep up the good work there.
Thank you, Steve.
We really appreciate you out there.
Thank you. You too. Tag, you're it. Pass it along. Pass along the good word. 1-866-889-8894. Richard in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Richard, we got about a half a minute left here. What's up?
Well, I just want to get it out there to all of your listeners. Please, I'm begging you, go to the Internet and just click on depleted uranium. Troops at risk. We are putting the people of this planet at risk in a way that is unprecedented.
Oh, yeah. We have fought several nuclear wars since Hiroshima. Today, by the way, the VJ Day anniversary. And those nuclear wars where we dropped massive amounts of nuclear material in the form of depleted uranium on Iraq, on Bosnia. Yes, we have been doing this for about a decade, and it's a horrible thing. And you've got hundreds of thousands of American servicemen coming home wounded from it, and millions of Iraqis. It's a terrible thing. Richard, thanks for the good point. You can just plug depleted uranium into Google. If you don't know what Richard is talking about, you'll get it. You'll get it very quickly. It's Tom Hartman Radio Program. The place where smart people get their news. The pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiteroadsociety.org, live on CRN Digital, on cable systems in 29 states, and podcasting at Apple iTunes and whiteroadsociety.org. Welcome back to our program. So pleased to have you with us. We were talking briefly about federalism, the Iraqi constitution, some of the challenges that are being faced in Iraq. David Enders is with us. David is the author of Baghdad Bulletin, a book published by the University of Michigan Press. You can find it on the web or in your local bookstore. He has just returned from Iraq to the United Kingdom, where he is right now, contributed three articles on the Iraq situation to Mother Jones. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm pleased to have you here. David, federalism, we read about it in the papers here. I think probably most Americans know that federalism means at least that there's a federal government and there's like state governments or counties or provinces or whatever, so, you know, semi-autonomous regions. Why is this such a big deal in Iraq?
Well, it's because the oil is in the north and south of the country and not in the center. And federalism has become code in the minds of many Iraqis for a attempt by the Kurdish population, and specifically the autonomous Kurdish authority in the north, to take over the oil city of Kirkuk, which falls out of their current boundaries, as well as an attempt by some of the southern provinces, which are largely sort of conservative Shiite provinces, to take a greater share of the oil wealth produced in that part of the country.
Which will leave the Sunnis in the center with nothing.
Essentially.
Now, the Sunnis, when, you know, there's an article in the New York Times today that says that basically the folks who are writing the Constitution may decide to ignore the Sunnis. Does that mean that they're going to just going to go ahead with federalism in the Constitution?
It's quite possible. It's not so much the people that are writing the Constitution as the National Assembly, which, because Sunnis generally didn't vote either out of fear of retribution or because they were refusing to legitimate January's elections, have no say in the National Assembly, which will vote on the draft of the Constitution that will be put up presumably for a ratification referendum in October. One possibility, though, is that Sunnis will vote in that referendum and vote against the Constitution, setting the process back even further. I've spoken with people in the western part of the country and a number of Sunni leaders before I left Baghdad, and they say they're encouraging their constituents to vote against the Constitution if a compromise isn't reached within the National Assembly.
So is there any knowledge of whether the lack of oil in the central part of the country and the Sunni part of the country is the result of the fact that there just hasn't been development there, or if there really isn't oil under the ground?
I've heard different stories. I've heard that potentially the largest fields in the country are somewhere around Baghdad, although certainly the working ones, the tapped ones, are not. I couldn't tell you one way or the other.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting, because that certainly would change the dynamic of things. If they don't go with the federal government, if they don't go with, or with federalism, if they don't go with a government where you have individual semi-autonomous states like we have here in the United States, like you have in the UK, then what's the alternative?
Well, the Sunnis are pushing for a strong central government such as there was before. And
where basically the whole country's run out of Baghdad.
Right, and the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north are against it, not just for the reasons of oil revenues, but also the southern governorates were severely oppressed by the last government and underfunded.
Yeah. So and plus they were generating all the revenue and they were getting little of it back. You know, they were pumping
exactly.
The oil. Right. So we hear talk that, you know, of civil war in Iraq, and then there are folks who say, We're already seeing a civil war in Iraq. To what extent is the violence that's being played out in Iraq on a day-to-day basis right now a symptom of a civil war that represents regional factionalism like this, or regional/religious/ethnic factionalism, versus the violence that is simply nationalism, where they're saying, you know, Americans get out of our country? Or some third variable in there?
Virtually all of the Iraqi-on-Iraqi violence is sort of occurring on a sectarian basis or a collaborationist basis. I couldn't give you a percentage one way or the other.
Is that most of the violence that's happening?
Well, because what happens is sectarianism goes along with politics. Most of the people collaborating with the occupation tend to be Shiites. So when you do have people striking out against, you know, the new police, you're going to have them killing mostly Shiites. Also, 60% of the population at least is Shiite.
Right.
There's a much lower level of actually honest-to-God sectarian violence. And even today I saw a report out of Ramadi in, you know, western Iraq, which is largely Sunni, that some of the secular anti-government and anti-occupation resistance there took up arms against the Sunni Islamist Salafist resistance, who were threatening to kick out the Shiites, the Shiite minority in Ramadi.
Mm. So it's happening all over. We're looking at the Balkanization. Ethnic cleansing is actually what that kind of sounds like.
Balkanization, Lebanonization, ethnic cleansing, exactly.
So this morning, by the way, a few hours ago, was the deadline for the Constitution. Do you know the latest on what's happened with that?
I spoke to a friend there maybe 4 or 5 hours ago, who said that they are likely at this point to ask for a 2-week extension.
Yeah. Okay. And in all probability, we'll get it.
Even though that is illegal under the transitional administrative law, which is technically, in theory, governing this process, which states that if they don't ask for a extension by August 1st, and then can't agree on a draft by the deadline, which is already passed, the National Assembly should be dissolved and new elections should be held.
Hmm.
So I don't know if we're just going to, I assume that whole thing is just going to be ignored, because the nightmare of holding elections, I don't think, is anything anyone wants to go through.
They're just going to ignore the law.
I think so.
Now, the Pentagon tells us that there's a whole other set of Abu Ghraib photographs that have not yet come out that are even worse than the ones that have been so widely circulated. And apparently there's a lot of activity going on within the Pentagon and in this administration to try and prevent these things from coming out, and a lot of fear that somebody will leak them. What happens if or when these photographs come out? Is that going to further inflame things, or have we just already so completely devastated our reputation in that area that it's irredeemable and nothing could make it worse?
I don't think you could do a whole lot more to sour Iraqis on the occupation. I mean, you were already there when the initial photographs came out. It'd be interesting to see, though, if Americans would react, because they seem to have pretty well forgotten about the whole thing.
Yeah, or accepted it. I mean, you had Rush Limbaugh saying, right, hey, boys will be boys, and they're blowing off steam, and this is a frat party, and the Reich wing here in the United States pretty much adopted that position.
Well, and I mean, are these photographs from you know, the initial thing, or since then? Because one thing that I don't think Americans realize is that people are still being incarcerated and beaten, and you know, there's no accountability whatsoever for the military.
Although increasingly it's not so much the U.S. that's doing it as it is the local military, is it not?
Well,
or is it
in
both?
Some cases, the U.S. still has more than 12,000 detainees, you know, prisoners, and essentially at any time on any of its bases holds somewhere around 1,000 who are essentially off the books. They're not even in the system that, you know, the Red Cross has access to.
Disappeared people.
Exactly.
Yeah, remarkable. One of our callers has a question for you. Mind taking a caller?
No, not at all.
Okay, we're talking with David Enders. He's the author of the book Baghdad Bulletin. And by the way, David, do you have a website?
Yeah.
BaghdadBulletin.com, right?
No, know, it's easiest to just Google my name.
Okay, E-N-D-E-R-S.
Yeah, my blog will come up, and, okay. And then, you know, you can get the book on Amazon.
Okay, great. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on listening on WTKG, is with us. Tomas, you have a question for David?
Yes, thanks for the opportunity. David, how do the different factions view the part of the Constitution that has to deal with Islam being the official religion and Sharia law? And I'll just listen on the radio there, brother.
Okay, thanks, Tomas. Good question. There's this debate about whether they're going to say Islamic law is a basis for the Constitution or the basis for the Constitution. David?
Well, the real question is, right now there's a push to have an article in the Constitution stating that no laws can be made that contradict Islamic law. So whether or not it is a basis or the basis, if you're not allowed to make laws in contradiction with Islamic law, you're essentially saying that it is more or less the basis.
So Islamic law says that women cannot vote and participate in civil society, that they have to be covered, that hands are cut off for stealing, that people are beheaded for murder and certain other crimes. I mean, am I getting this wrong, or is that just how it's instituted in Saudi Arabia?
That's how it's instituted in Saudi Arabia.
You can't drink alcohol, you can't shave your beard.
Right, we're talking about sort of Iran-style Islamic law, which is a little different, and has been amended to obviously allow women to vote, and is not quite as harsh as what we see in Saudi Arabia. I mean, none of these interpretations are you know, strictly Quranic, I don't think. You know, there's always, you know, a little bit of leeway for...
Yeah.
For,
so,
you know, the current situation.
We have about a minute left here, David Enders. I'm wondering if you think, you know, I think the question behind Tomas's question was, is Iraq heading towards a theocratic government or not?
In some ways, in some places, it's already sort of there. The police are either made up of members of Islamic militias or turn a blind eye to extrajudicial killings. I think this is another one of those issues where you're seeing fragmentation within the country. Baghdad is more cosmopolitan, the south more homogenous, and the Kurds in the north are quite secular and don't want any sort of Islam. This is one of the major sticking points. It's the Kurds who are opposing it, this language of writing with Islamic law. So I think really, and this is another thing where the oil is the big issue with federalization, but also likely the southern provinces will probably have slightly different laws than the ones in the north.
Right. Okay, great. David Enders, thank you so much for being with us, David.
Thank you.
From all the way from the UK there. I much appreciate it. You can find, just Google David, E-N-D-E-R-S, David Enders, for more information about David and the work that he's doing. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And you are in the real free speech zone.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you understand the way I'm feeling today? The button's pushed, there's no running away. No one's safe with the world in the grave.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, 1-866-888-9894. Our telephone number, Ellen Ratner's with us, the Talk Radio News Service, our bureau chief in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the White House is exuberant that the deficit is $331 billion as opposed to $365 billion.
When during the Clinton administration, it was zero.
Well,
there was no deficit.
They say that under their plan it will be 1% of GDP, even though it's currently 2.7% of GDP. But the Democrats today, with John Spratt, who is the ranking member of the Budget Committee, said that essentially these tax cuts, if they are renewed, will actually make the budget go to, the deficit go to $647 billion as of the year 2015. That's just, it's 9 years away.
Wow.
And that, they took budget assumptions, even including $80 billion a year for supplemental for Afghanistan and Iraq for 10 years as part of it.
What's not included, by the way, Ellen, in that 300 and some odd billion dollar budget deficit is the fact that this year they borrowed about $200 billion from Social Security. The actual deficit would have been over 500. Okay, go ahead.
Basically, it's about what they're saying is they are now saying, well, they're going to have a $170 billion deficit in 2010, which, of course, is much less. But it is only because of the Social Security surplus, which increases until the year 2018, and is, of course, that's encumbered money, but they're not including it that way.
Right.
So it's just, you know, it's just numbers. It's just pieces of paper. So the Bush administration is taking that Social Security surplus and the Medicare money and saying, okay, well, this is why we're going to be able to decrease the deficit. But that money is accounted for.
Right. They're borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund, and they're borrowing from the Medicare surplus, and then they're pretending like they never borrowed that money.
Exactly. Exactly.
And they're lying to the American people, saying, see, our deficit's only $300 billion, when in fact they actually spent over $550, $600 billion that they borrowed. It's just that half of it they borrowed from within the federal government, even though it has to be paid back to the federal government because it has to be used to pay our Social Security checks eventually. They're saying, oh, it doesn't exist. We didn't really borrow it.
Well, it's interesting. It's also on Social Security. If they have a Social Security, if they go with this plan, it will only add, and I will say only, $750 billion over the next 10. But over the next 20 years, it adds $4 trillion to the deficit.
Wow. Wow. What will add $4 trillion to the deficit?
If they go with the president's Social Security plan, initially over the next 10 years.
Oh, you're talking about his privatization scheme.
Right. There is a surplus. Right. As you know, till the year 2018.
Right.
So for that 10 years, it only adds $750 billion, not that that's not a lot, it's almost another trillion, to the deficit. But if it goes over 20 years, which is when us boomers will be around,
hopefully,
that's right, it adds $4 trillion to the deficit.
Mind-boggling. Any word on Bush and Cindy Crawford? Cindy Sheehan down in Crawford?
He doesn't have anything this week. That is, he has no public events this week. So he's just on his little ranch enjoying himself.
Yeah, so he's just going to be down there cutting brush and...
Cutting shrubs, cutting bushes. Right, exactly, and going on long bike rides. Meanwhile, there is some word that they're trying to... Well, first of all, we now are learning that Senator McCain is going to be going to Iowa to help Jim Nussel raise money to be governor of Iowa. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's his presidential bid.
For John McCain.
You got it.
Yeah, so John McCain apparently is seriously looking at 2008. Very interesting. Okay. It's going to be an interesting next couple of years here, Ellen. Ellen, thanks a lot for the report today. Much appreciated. Good to hear from you. I'm Tom Hartman, exposing the con in conservative. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Some folks have all learned to wave the flag, pull the red, white, and blue. But when the band plays Hail to the Chief, ooh, that boy can cannon at you.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. George Bush refuses to set timetable for his withdrawal from Crawford, Texas. We are told the presidential vacation is indefinite, Early end of vacation would send a terrible signal, the president says. This from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. President George W. Bush said today that he understands and respects the views of those who are calling for him to cut short his summer vacation, but warned that an immediate withdrawal from Crawford, Texas, would send a terrible signal to the enemy. The enemy would like nothing better than to see me cut short my vacation and get back to the White House, Mr. Bush told reporters. They hate my freedom. While the president said he would withdraw from Crawford soon, he refused to set a timetable for his departure from the ranch, saying that much work there still needs to be done. Mr. Bush, who has been spending much of his vacation clearing brush, said he is making great progress in training ranch hands to take over that job for him, but cautioned that they are not yet prepared to do the job for themselves. The president said, once the ranch hands have shown that they are able to clear the brush on their own, I will withdraw from Crawford, but that day has not yet come. Mr. Bush was dismissive of polls showing that the public thinks his current vacation is becoming a quagmire, much like his August 2001 vacation. At the White House, spokesman Scotty McClellan defended the president's decision to remain in Crawford indefinitely. He said, President Bush deserves August off, especially when you consider how many summers he had to go to school. Thank you, Andy Borowitz, from the BorowitzReport.com. So much in the news, remarkable, everything that's going on right now. We'll get into some of the more serious issues of the day, and we've got a Rush report coming up in a minute. But first, Steve in Grand Rapids is on the line. Our telephone number, we're toll-free, 1-866-889-8894. And, of course, you can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Click live chat. Hey, Steve.
Hi there, Tom. That was great when you quoted from Fahrenheit 9/11 a bit earlier in your bumper music.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that I am very proud of what Cindy Sheehan is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are saying that that this war in Iraq is a lot like Vietnam. And my thoughts are, if that's the case, I read an article that says then it's only a matter of time before we have this generation's equivalent to Kent State. Do you think what's happening with Cindy Sheehan could become that Kent State? What are the odds?
I think the odds are pretty slim. I think that this these guys in the Bush White House, although they've bungled a war in Iraq, they've been pretty good at controlling the message domestically. And they're not so dumb, I mean, as to ignore the lessons of history. Karl Rove has overtly said that he's patterning the Bush presidency after the McKinley presidency. McKinley, of course, lied us into the Spanish-American War.
And wasn't he the one that said the people should support the government, but the government should not support the people?
I don't recall, but it was McKinley in the late 1890s who claimed that the USS Maine had been attacked by the Spanish and thus justified our invasion of the Philippines and of Cuba and sparked the Spanish-American War that Teddy Roosevelt had to kind of wrap up. Although we were in a quagmire, we occupied the Philippines for 40 years. I mean, we still have military bases there, but for 40 years we were in a shooting war in the Philippines with insurgents. So that's the presidency that Karl Rove has said he was going to model a Bush presidency after. And the USS Maine was not attacked. Its boiler blew up. But McKinley used that as an excuse to start that war in order to gain political capital. The only thing that rescued America was that McKinley died while he was in office. And Teddy Roosevelt became president, and who was vice president at the time. So that, that sort of... And I got to tell you, first of all, George W. is doing everything he can to stay in good physical shape. It's more important to him than running the country, at number one. And number two, Dick Cheney is not a guy who would save America if anything, God forbid, were to happen to George W. Bush. And to add to that, I think it's fascinating that Bob Woodward, who is no dummy and probably has better connections inside the Bush White House than any reporter in Washington, D.C., is now coming out and saying that Dick Cheney is going to be running for president in 2008 on the Republican ticket.
So it's basically like a second Gilded Age.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Has been since Reagan. I mean, that's what it's been all about. It's the return of the robber barons. Explicitly, they're making no bones about it. It's not like they're trying to hide it. I mean, you got right wing talk radio trying to convince the average Joe driving his pickup truck that that's not what it's about. But if you read their policy statements, if you read their papers, if you look at what they're doing, that's absolutely what it's all about. It's all about economics.
So Joe Sixpack's falling for it, but we aren't.
Yeah. Yeah, and increasingly Joe Sixpack isn't. Steve, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you.
Great.
I appreciate it. A federal judge, this is from the Associated Press today, a federal judge blocked the Bush administration plans to overhaul personnel and pay rules at the Department of Homeland Security, saying the government-wide change of labor rules fails to protect workers' collective bargaining rights. This is a really interesting thing. The Department of Homeland Security. Well, in fact, let me back up a little bit. Three years ago or so, George Bush said that it was his goal to reduce the federal labor workforce by some 700,000, 800,000 employees. Now, he wasn't actually suggesting that 700,000 people would no longer be being paid with tax dollars. What he was suggesting was that there were 700,000 to 800,000 jobs that were being done at the federal level where you had federal employees who had good wages, good pensions, and were members of one of the largest unions in the United States, that those employees could be replaced by employees from private contractors who are not unionized, who don't have pensions, who don't have benefits, and who will work for less money. At the same, now you would think, you know, as a citizen, as the guy who's picking up the tab, as the taxpayer, you'd say, oh, cool, so we pay fewer taxes. Well, no, it doesn't work quite that way, because the CEOs of those private companies are going to make out like bandits. The stockholders of those private companies have to be paid their dividends. There has to be a profit. As we've seen in Iraq, you've got, you know, the private contractors now serving meals to grunts, to GIs. I didn't mean that in a negative way. Private contractors serving meals to GIs in Iraq, and the private contractors are being paid $150,000 a year because, you know, and they've got all the armor that they need, and it's costing us far more. But it's privatization, so the Bushies are all gung-ho about it. They think it's a wonderful thing. And so the first step to this, of course, is breaking up the union. I mean, that's the real agenda here, is union busting on the part of the Bushies. That's half the agenda, let's say. Half the agenda is union busting. The other half is their religion of privatization, their religion that all things can be done correctly through corporations and no things can be done correctly by government. Which, of course, is demonstrably false, but nonetheless, this is their religion. And so the first step in this was last year when they reorganized the Department of Homeland Security. They took a whole bunch of jobs. I don't recall the exact number. My recollection is it was 86,000 jobs, but I may be wrong. If I am, I'm guessing somebody in the chat room will correct me, or somebody will call and let me know. But in any case, they took a bunch of jobs in the Department of Homeland Security, and they said, you folks can no longer be members of the union. Or if you're members of the union, you can no longer have a contract with the federal government that says that you have the right for collective bargaining and you have the right to you know, not even the right to strike. A lot of federal employees don't have the right to strike. It's why, you know, Reagan killed off PATCO. You don't have the right to even collectively bargain because we have to have flexibility to quickly respond to terrorist threats. As if Americans... As if Americans who are union members... Now, get the subtext to this. The subtext to this is really important because that suggests the frame. It suggests the frame that people get even though they don't realize they're getting it. This is one of those subliminal kind of NLP things. It is implying that a union employee, if the nation was under attack, would take an action that might harm the nation simply because he's a union employee. Or she. You get this? That agency officials said they have more flexibility to respond to terrorist threats. As if union employees would not want to quickly respond to terrorist threats. As if union employees would want to obstruct any activity by this government to respond to terrorist threats. I mean, this is the worst kind of demagoguery to come out of the Bush administration. Well, it's the worst kind of demagoguery, period. It's not the worst kind that's come out of the Bush administration, but it's right up there. And so when the Pentagon, by the way, is trying to do the same thing in the Department of Defense, and this Judge Collier, in her ruling, which was issued last Friday, she said that the new rules exceed the scope of federal law, citing in particular provisions giving an agency official unchecked authority to change negotiated positions in a collective bargaining agreement. The judge wrote, and I quote from her decision, "The regulations fail because any collective bargaining negotiations pursuant to its terms are illusory. The secretary retains numerous avenues by which she or he can unilaterally declare contract terms null and void without prior notice to the unions or employees and without bargaining or recourse. In other words, these new regulations that the Pentagon has put forward, that the Department of Homeland Security has put forward, that essentially say, union? What union? These are illegal. And again, you're going to hear the Bushies saying, oh, but we've got to have these regulations because those nasty union members, they will say, if the country was attacked, they will try to obstruct things. I mean, just look at those unionized firefighters in New York City when 9/11 happened, and the unionized police officers in New York City when 9/11 happened. Look at the terrible job they did, would say the Republicans. See, that's proof. And this is obscene. This is just absolutely obscene. At the same time today in the Wall Street Journal, they talk about, you know, the two attempts to purchase American companies by China, and attempts to buy Unocal and Maytag, have gotten a lot of press. And rightly so. People are looking at, you know, Maytag and going, whoa, or China and going, whoa, what happened? But they point out that that's just nothing. In fact, as Ravi Shamangan, head of the Mergers and Acquisition Strategy Unit at Accenture Limited, says, it's a trickle turning into a stream, but an unmistakable trend in our view. What's that trickle? Emerging market countries all over the world. This is from John Hilsenroth in today's Wall Street Journal. Emerging market countries all over the world, including Israel, Singapore, Brazil, India, and Mexico. What are they doing? They're buying up America. Why? Because the Bush administration's trade policies and tax policies have made us so bankrupt that the only way we can continue doing business is to sell ourselves off. As the Wall Street Journal notes, during the first 7 months of the year, companies from less advanced economies were behind 70 deals to buy U.S. companies with a total value of just over $10 billion. Over $10 billion. Companies from Mexico, companies from Singapore, companies from Israel. The acquisition activity reflects the fast growth of many emerging market countries, which have racked up a current account surplus with the rest of the world that is expected to hit $300 billion this year. In other words, we're loaning them money so we can buy stuff from them, and then with that money that we're loaning them, they say, what am I going to do with all these dollars? Oh, I think I'll go to America and buy a company. And like China, the Wall Street Journal notes, other emerging market countries want to use their rising wealth to quickly buy entry into U.S. markets. Ta-da! You too will soon be working for a company based in Guatemala. I mean, who knows? Who knows? It's just, you know, where is this going to go? This is just not a good sign. This is just not a good sign. Joyce in Holland, Michigan on the line. Hey, Joyce, what's on your mind today?
Well, I tell you, that gal down in Texas, she certainly got a backbone.
Cindy Sheehan.
Strong, yes. She's got more backbone than all those Bushes put together.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you.
And I'm represented, or not represented, by Pete Hoekstra.
Uh-huh.
And he always votes everything for the companies.
Yeah, well, you know which side his bread is buttered on.
Yes, yes. And that vote that they had for CAFTA.
Yes.
And the transportation one first, and then getting that. I stayed up until 1 o'clock that night because they voted from 11 till 17 minutes after. And it was supposed to be stopped then. Then the people would have won. But they did their time delay and them did their arm twisting, and they kept that vote open until 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So
same as with Medicare.
By two, yes. And then reminded these people that the other vote is coming up, you know, and how you're going to stand on that.
Yeah.
I don't know what we can do. I have been an activist in the union movement for many years. And
well, what we have to do, Joyce, is we have to wake other people up. I mean, that is our job one. It's the tag you're at. It's we have to wake up other people. Speaking out like you're doing, calling talk radio shows, speaking out, calling conservative talk radio shows and speaking out, writing letters to the editor of your local papers, writing letters to the editors of your local television stations and radio stations, particularly when you see news that has a bias to it, or calling them. and speaking out, calling 1-877-SOB-USOB, the toll-free phone number for Congress, and speak with Pete Hoekstra's staff and tell him what you think of what he's doing and that you're going to actively work against him for re-election if he doesn't start getting with the program and voting in favor of the interests of the people rather than just the big corporations that are lining his pockets.
Would you give me that number again?
Sure. It's toll-free. It's 1-877-
1-877.
And then and this is all the letters that you would, you know how you dial the letters on your.
Okay.
S-O-B.
That's what he is.
Yeah. The followed by the letter U, as in USA.
Uh-huh.
U-S-O-B.
Oh, that's great. Now,
yeah,
I'm
it's easy to remember. 1-877-SOB-USOB. That's the phone number for Congress.
What about in Florida? I go to Florida, to Clearwater, Florida. Is there any way I can get you down there?
In Clearwater, Florida, you can pick us up on Sirius Satellite Radio. We don't have an affiliate station right in that area right at the moment.
And I don't have that kind of radio.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that choice. But, you know, we're growing. We've just added a couple more affiliates this week, but step by step. But we're not.
Well, you know, my
yet.
Brother didn't come back from World War II, and I would have been married 60 years now. But it's amazing that this man can do all this kind of stuff, and they say it's all in the name of Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus never heard of this kind of stuff.
I don't at all disagree with you, Joyce, and thank you very much for calling. It's great to hear from you, and tag your it. You know, keep passing the good word. Spread it along. Thanks for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't worry about the ABM treaty. Don't worry what the Russians will say. 'Cause when we have control of outer space, we can blow them all away.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, and Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida on the line. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Hi. You know, this issue of energy costs are affecting virtually everybody but Rush Limbaugh and his pals.
Yeah.
And when the winter comes.
And the Bushies.
Yeah, and when the winter comes, it's really going to hit people.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you look back over past recessions, the six most severe recessions since the Great Depression, five of the six were preceded by a spike in energy prices. And if you and also what's interesting is if you look at housing prices and the increase in inventory that we're looking at now, and housing prices are actually starting to drop in some markets, the last time that this happened big time was during the last Bush recession.
Yeah.
So, you know, the last time that there was a spike in energy prices, the last time that there was a drop in housing prices was during the last Bush recession, which was in 91. And here we have another Bush recession. And I'm just amazed people don't point out, you know, the people talk about the unemployment figures are worse than since 1991. And they don't add when George Bush, when senior was president. Right. And it's like,
right.
You know, we're going back to the last Bush presidency economically. Why? Because it's the same in economic insanity.
Right. But I want to tell people, I want to give people, I know you lived in Europe, so you're probably going to know what I anticipate what I'm going to say. But there is a method that someone can do today to cut back on the amount of gasoline they're consuming without driving their car any less. And that's this. This is a technique that you know the taxi drivers use in Europe. When you most people drive the same locations every day. They go to the work, whatever. You know where there are long stoplights.
Just turn your car off.
Turn it off.
Yeah, and it's not just the taxi drivers who do it. In the small towns, everybody does it in Europe, or at least in Germany. Yeah.
Turn off the car.
And my Prius does it automatically.
Oh, really?
Yeah, anytime you go below about 5-10 miles an hour, the motor just turns itself off.
Oh, well, that's something people can do tomorrow. It's not, you know, it's too simple for Bush to understand.
Yeah.
But for everyone else, turn it off.
Yeah, I understand that somewhere between 5 and 7% of all the gasoline used in the United States is used idling at stoplights.
Yeah.
And just that one little change that you find in my Prius, where the car just automatically turns itself off whenever you stop, would save all that fuel. Thanks a lot, Phil, for the call. Good to hear from you. I mean, that's you know, 10% of our gasoline is, that's pretty mind-blowing. Of all our gasoline, That would probably represent at least half our imports from Saudi Arabia, all the money that we're giving to the madrasas to teach people to hate Americans, right? Or to hate the West, or to hate, you know, whatever. It might be a start, but it's, as Phil points out, too much for the Bushies. Far too much for them.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on CRN Digital, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, Sirius Satellite Radio. Jack Davis is with us. Jack is the founder of Save American Jobs. You can find them on the web at saveamericanjobs.us. And, Jack, in fact, I understand that you are a former conservative.
Yes, I voted for Goldwater in 64.
Well, I worked on Goldwater's campaign in 64. So.
All right. We're about the same age then, maybe, eh?
Yeah, well, I was 13 at the time. Yeah, I think you may be just a bit older than me if you were old enough to vote for him. But in any case...
You worked there and you weren't old enough to vote?
No, yeah, my dad was up there in the county Republicans, and, you know, I got all swept up in it. And 3 years later, I was out in East Lansing at Michigan State University protesting the war, and I had had my awakening, as it were.
Okay.
But in any case...
I've had my awakening, too.
Yeah, okay. So here we are. And, in fact, you ran for political office recently, did you not?
I did what?
You ran for political office recently?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did that in 04 for the 26th New York District against Tom Reynolds.
He was the chairman of the GOP in that state, was he not, in New York?
Yeah, he still is.
Yeah, still is. Okay. Well, hopefully 2 years from now you'll be able to take it all the way. I believe you got like 45% of the vote, didn't you?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, that's
that. I'm telling people I'm keeping my options open at this point. I haven't committed to run, but I'm really concerned about the loss of jobs in this country and the free trade policies and the globalization. That's what I ran on before, and if I run again, that will be my platform.
There you go, these so-called free trade agreements.
So-called free trade, right.
Yeah, because really, they're not free, and they are agreements. I mean, they're in some cases thousands of pages of rules and regulations to govern the trade that have replaced tariffs, which have protected American industries. Now,
let me just back up on that. I think they're treaties. And
yeah.
If there are treaties, they shouldn't be able to pass these CAFTA regulations with a majority vote. It should take two-thirds of the vote in the Senate, because this is a contract between countries, and that requires two-thirds the vote of the Senate. And that seems to be completely overlooked by many people.
Now, so NAFTA, CAFTA, and the GATT, which produced WTO, none of those required a two-thirds majority vote?
None of them got it, no.
Because they were all called agreements rather than treaties.
That is right.
Is there a legal distinction that has precedent in history? I mean, are there any cases that would back you up on that?
Well, I'm having a constitutional attorney look at that now to see if that couldn't be one of my approaches to this problem.
Yeah. Although I think, frankly, for both you and I, the best approach is we just need to educate enough people to say, hey, you know, George Bush taught us that whether it's a treaty or an agreement, we can walk away from it. He did that with the anti-ballistic missile treaty. You know,
he comes into
office and he says, hey, we got a treaty with the Soviet Union? Not anymore. We're walking away from that sucker.
Yep.
And we could do the same thing with CAFTA. We could do the same thing with NAFTA. We could do the same thing with WTO. We could simply tomorrow morning say, sorry, we're not playing anymore.
That's what I'd like to have, Carl. That would make the happiest day of my life if that would come out.
Yeah, and it would be the best thing for the United States of America.
Absolutely.
Just very, very simple, very straightforward. Jack, how do you explain this to people? I mean, here you've been in the political arena, and you know, you kind of get that. How do you explain to people that these trade agreements are destructive to us, and the tariffs are the way we've traditionally protected industries? And have them get it. I mean, most people don't even understand what a tariff is or what a trade agreement is. Do you have some way of making this comprehensible?
I don't, and I wish I did. I've tried many, many approaches. What I have found that the working guy, the blue collar, the gray collar work, they understand this. But you get into the guys that graduated from Princeton or Harvard or Yale or some of these other economic white towers, ivory towers, that they still are tied to this free trade is good for everybody.
But they don't get it.
No, they don't get it.
They
are so stubborn and know-it-all that it's just an impossible situation.
It's really quite remarkable. You know, the way that I describe it to people is I say, hey, traditionally in the United States, because we, you know, it's always been the case that you can make, for example, shoes. You can make shoes cheaper, you know, in other countries. I mean, from the founding of this country, you can make shoes cheaper in other countries. And so traditionally what we said, and this is true of ball bearings or anything else, traditionally what we said is, you want to make shoes in Malaysia? No problem. If it costs $1 worth of labor to make a pair of shoes in the United States and 10 cents worth of labor to make a pair of shoes in Malaysia, we'll simply tax you 90 cents when you import those shoes from Malaysia so that when you, by the time they make our shores, it's cost you the equivalent of $1, 10 cents for the labor and 90 cents for the tax. We call that tax a tariff. And so you can choose to make them in Malaysia and it'll cost you $1. You can choose to make them here and it'll cost you $1. What are you going to do? And people will go, well, you know, to ship it all the way from Malaysia is going to be more expensive than to ship it from South Carolina, so I think I'll just make them here. And that's why we made shoes in the United States for 200 years.
And that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
And
then Reagan came along and started dismantling these things, and you know, Bush took it a little farther with Fast Track, and then Clinton just kicked the door open with NAFTA and GATT and WTO, and now we've got CAFTA, and, you know, five successive presidencies of just insane trade policies, and now we owe the world trillions of dollars. The Chinese are holding so much of our debt that they could destroy us economically. Tomorrow morning, the Chinese could produce a Great Depression that would make 1929 look like a picnic if they got upset with us, simply by dumping on the world market our treasuries or refusing to sell us things. We can't build a missile now without parts from China.
You're absolutely right, Tom, and it's been a concern of mine now for over 3 years, and like you, I talk about it all the time, and I got so aggravated I decided to run for Congress because I felt talking to people is not enough.
Yeah.
Putting articles in the paper is not enough. You got to go to Washington where the power is, where the controls are, and I felt I would be heard there. But it's a struggle to beat an incumbent. In this district that I ran in last time, there's a it's been gerrymandered, so there's 50,000 more Republicans than there are
Democrats.
So it's just uphill battle. But
you ran as a Democrat, Jack.
Yes, I ran as a Democrat.
Jack, we're talking with Jack Davis, the founder of Save American Jobs. The website saveamericanjobs.us. Is there another presence on the web you'd like people to know about, Jack?
Yes, I've also started a political party, that savejobsparty.com.
SaveJobsParty.com. Okay.
And they also make it very difficult to start a party in New York State.
Yeah.
You can't become official party until you get over 50,000 votes in a governor's election. So it's just so stacked against somebody that's a patriot and a concerned citizen to be heard, to get recognized, and to beat an incumbent.
This is why I think it's so important to work within the two political parties, even if you have a third party. You know, you've started one. A lot of people who listen to this program are also members of the Greens or Progressive Party, things like that, even a Ross Perot's old party. And still, I tell them, you know, do that. That's great. In fact, a lot of really good work is being done on the local level, particularly by the Green Party. They've got over 200 communities now in the United States, maybe over 300 using instant runoff voting and things like that. You know, they're campaigning for clean elections. But still, infiltrate the Democratic or Republican Party.
Oh, yeah.
Get
so,
inside.
One of the things that's an advantage, New York is what they call the fusion party state. So you can run on a major party and also get the endorsements of other parties. So if I run again, I would have the Democratic Party line, the Working Families Party line, but a party line, Save Jobs Party, that many Republicans wouldn't vote for a Democrat. But if there's a Save Jobs Party line, I think I can get some switchovers with that.
Okay, great. We have a listener in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who has a question for you. Mind taking a caller?
No, that'd be fine.
Okay, we're talking with Jack Davis, SaveAmericanJobs.us, and say it again. I'm sorry, the other one. Your other website?
Yeah, SaveJobsParty.com.
There you go. And Will in Pittsburgh is on the line. Hey, Will, welcome to the program. You're live with Jack Davis.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Will. How you doing?
Thank you.
I grew up in Pittsburgh. I grew up in Wilkinsburg. We're neighbors.
I'm from McKees Rocks.
All right, I know where it is.
I don't, I've been out in Wilkinsburg, worked out there. Mr. Davis, since time is limited for me, how in God's name are we? You know, my father always said, it's too late to buy fire insurance when a house is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
I watched this destruction by our, not just, like Tom mentioned here, for the last 30 years by all the Congress and our leaders. America was powerful economically because we used to buy from ourselves. We made our own products. We bought from ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
How in God's name do you think we're going to stem the tide of these brutal billionaire businesses who are looking for slave wages all over the world? And put, like Tom just said, China can bury us tomorrow if they want to. And you can't change it, Mr. Davis. Tell me how we're going to...
Well, first of all, well, I don't give up. I'm an ex-Marine, and I don't like to be told something I can't do. I'm an optimist. I started a company 40 years ago when I had two large competitors, the Carbonum Company and the Norton Company. They no longer exist. I don't mind big mountains to climb, and I won't give up on our country, and I think I can do more in Washington and talking on talk shows with people. Like,
although that's a start.
Yeah, that's a good start. Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity.
And Will, thanks
for
the call.
But I'm not a defeatist, and I know that people like myself and Tom have to stand up for what they think is right and make ourselves heard.
And the reality is Americans are starting to figure this out, Jack.
Oh, yes.
I mean, they're starting to realize. It's the real shocker is when you look back, you know, George Bush keeps running around going, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war. Well, during World, first of all, the period of time from 9/11 till today is 2.5-3 months longer than the entire time that we were in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time that we were in World War II, we successfully shifted a peacetime economy that had no infrastructure to make military goods of any consequence into an entirely military infrastructure. We built tanks, we built battleships, we built airplanes, you know, fighter planes, we built bombs, military, because we had the ability to do it. We had the steel mills, we had the tool and die shops, we had the, you know, right on down the, you know, Chrysler was on their assembly lines, and they were making tanks instead of cars. You know, instead of making the nylon hose, they were making parachutes. We had the industrial infrastructure. We have lost the majority of that now. We don't have the ability to go to a wartime. You know, one of the reasons why we've got so many soldiers running around getting killed in Iraq is because we don't have the ability to even make armor for their Humvees.
That's right.
And it's like,
we just can't let it go. It's so important, Will, that we have to make a change. People like you and Tom and others have to stand up and say, look, it's too much. You've made a mistake. We have to reverse the course of history. That free trade does not work.
Yeah, well said. Jack Davis, we've been talking with Jack Davis. Jack, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, anytime. I'd like to talk to you again, Tom.
Yeah, and Will, thank you for your call. The website is saveamericanjobs.us and savejobsparty.com.
Gotcha.
There you go. Jack Davis, founder of Save American Jobs. You're a great man, a fine patriot, and doing a great job out there, Jack. Thank you so much
for
being with
us. Thank you, Tom.
Bye.
Goodbye.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, we can kind of hope that that's not Karl Rove's song. Welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Washington Post today has an interesting article, Democrats Conflicted on Playing Rough. And they point out that Narol, the groups that the so-called pro-lifers, the anti-abortion folks, like to portray as the pro-abortion group. Let's say that they're in favor of a woman's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion, that they believe that the decision should be between a woman and her physician, pure and simple. NARAL had run an ad, NARAL Pro-Choice America, had run an ad about John Roberts, the Supreme Court nominee, that essentially said that this guy back in 92 or 93, whatever year it was, had argued a decision that said without going into the whole intricacies of the whole thing, that Roberts' argument had set up a situation where it would be more difficult for the federal government. Roberts was arguing that this should be left to the states. More difficult for the federal government to track down and prosecute abortion clinic bombers and folks like this. And then they talk about, the abortion clinic bombing in Atlanta. Was it Eric Rudolph who did that? Whoever did it. In any case, they talk about that. And then they point out that as soon as the ad was criticized, NARAL pulled the ad. They're no longer running that ad. Because, a few folks on TV said, well, this ad isn't truthful. Because the ad sort of implied that Judge Roberts' decision came... Well, it's not that the ad implied, it's that you could conclude from watching the ad, I guess it's the same thing, that Judge Roberts' decision came after the clinic bombing, when in fact it came before it. Well, there is some legitimacy to that criticism, having seen the ad and seen the criticism, and I think that NARAL could have been a little more artful in the way they put together the ad, and either they were misinformed or they were engaging a little bit of hyperbole. But the larger question here is, look at what happened when the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth ran ads against John Kerry that contained outright lies, distortions, and falsehoods. And they got called on it. And the Republican Party, they just shrugged. They just shrugged. Bob Schrum, the guy who has been the lead advisor to several failed Democratic presidential campaigns, tragically, I think that John Kerry's biggest mistake was hiring Bob Schrum to run his campaign. But anyhow, Bob Schrum says in this Washington Post piece today, he says, Republicans don't mind running an ad that's entirely false, but Democrats have never learned, and I'm not sure many of them want to learn how to play that kind of politics. And so, are the Democrats able to play hardball? Republican operative Greg Mueller, this from the Washington Post piece today, who advised the Swift Boat Group, said the NARAL ad was pulled not because of Democratic wavering, but because it was so false, so outrageously false, blah de blah de blah. He says Republicans have never done anything even close to that level of dishonesty. I beg to differ. Willie Horton, I mean, you just go down the list. But the bottom line is it possible that the Democratic Party, that the Democrats in general, are just so wed to the idea of being decent people, that that's like a foundational part of the whole notion of the Democratic Party, going all the way back to its founding by Thomas Jefferson in 1798, that the idea of believing in we the people and believing that it's important to be truthful and honest, and that the Democrats are so wed to this idea that they'll never be able to play the kind of vicious hardball that the Republicans routinely play, where they routinely lie to people, engage in deception in order to and play wedge politics, vilify people based on race, Willie Horton ads based on gender, all of the anti-gay resolutions that were passed by the various states in the past, the Democrats just don't have it in them because they're just like fundamentally decent. Whereas the Republicans are willing to, lie, cheat, and steal, as it were, to achieve their goals. It's a fascinating question. Is there something to the DNA of this? Is there something to how people grew up that causes them to be able to behave in these ways? I suspect it is. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, Yeah, they build the death planes. Yeah, they build all the bombs.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, the Masters of War. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The True People's Radio, telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. Amy in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to call to say that, you know, I think you're right on about Democrats being too good to fight the Republican way. And I think, but what we can do, I think, is we need to stand up every single time there is a lie or an injustice, not pick our fights. I hear so many times the Democrats and, you know, the Senate and the Congress say, you know, we need to pick our fights.
Keep our powder dry,
yes,
they say.
Yes.
It's nonsense.
It's absolutely stupid nonsense.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Professor Jack Forbes of the University of California wrote a book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. And he's a professor of Native American studies. He's Native American himself. And I interviewed him when I was writing my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And he said that when the Native Americans were confronted with the white Europeans, they concluded that we were infected with an infectious mental disease that he called wetiko, which in whichever Native American language that is means one who eats the life of others, cannibals.
Oh, absolutely.
And that they were confronted with basically three choices. They could either be eaten, that is, be wiped out. They could fight back and lose, knowing that they would lose. Or they could become like us. And they chose, or number four, they could flee. They could run away. And in most cases, they chose that fourth option. Occasionally, they tried to fight back. Very rarely did they try to become like us. But, you know, it's one of those difficult things where if you engage the enemy on their own turf, you become the enemy. And this is the thing that indigenous people around the world are facing. And this is the struggle that I think the Democrats are facing.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call, Amy. It's just a fascinating thing. And so Gandhi faced the same thing. Jesus faced this. I mean, you know, 2,000 years ago, the Roman occupation of the Middle East, of Israel, of Palestine, whatever you want to call it, the Roman occupation there, and you know, the folks are like, you know, how do we respond to the Romans? And people say, well, you know, Jesus said, turn the other cheek and walk a mile, and, you know, if somebody takes your coat, give them your cloak as well. If you dig a little deeper, though, you discover that the Romans had anti-exploitation laws. It was perfectly okay for the Romans, during that Roman occupation time, it was perfectly okay for a Roman citizen to come upon a citizen of an occupied territory, be the equivalent of like a U.S. GI coming to an Iraqi. It was perfectly okay to say, I need your help here. Help me carry this from here over to there. But if the over there was more than a mile, then it wasn't okay anymore. Because then you would have Roman citizens exploiting local people to the point that there would be rebellions, and Rome didn't want there to be rebellions. So they had these anti-exploitation laws, and the anti-exploitation laws said that you couldn't make somebody carry something more than one mile. There was a tradition back then that, because they didn't have toilet paper back then, the way that people cleaned themselves after they used the toilet, or what was a hole in the ground, after they went, was with their left hand, and so the left hand was considered unclean. You never touched somebody with your left hand. Now, just imagine if there's somebody standing in front of you right now, and if you reach up with your left hand and slap their face, which side of their face is your left hand going to touch as it strikes their face? It'll be the right cheek, right? Now, the tradition back then, and if you strike somebody with your right hand, you'll hit their left cheek. Now, the tradition back then was that you could insult. The Romans allowed you to insult somebody by slapping them with the unclean hand, the left hand. But if a Roman citizen struck somebody with their right hand, that was a challenge to a fight, and the person had the right to fight back. Or the Roman citizen, by striking somebody with the right hand, was engaging in something more than an insult. They were engaging in an act of violence, and they could lose their citizenship. Similarly, if a Roman citizen asked somebody to carry something more than a mile, they would lose their citizenship. There was this old deal where people basically had two pieces of clothing. They had the thing that they wore during the hot daytime, and then they had another coat that went, called a cloak, and then they had a coat that went over the outside of that they would wear at night, and they would sleep in it. It was like an all-purpose blanket, coat, the whole thing, right? Two pieces of clothing. And the Roman citizens, when somebody was indentured to them, they sent them out to work in the fields during the day or whatever, they would keep their coat as a way of, you know, forcing them to come back at night. Now, back then, if you took all of somebody's clothes so that they were naked, and you were the Roman citizen, and you took all of their clothes, and now you got somebody naked, you had committed a crime. Again, you had violated the anti-exploitation laws, and you could lose your Roman citizenship. So back during those times, if somebody struck you with their on the right cheek, if they struck you with their left hand on the right cheek, they had the right to do that. But if you turned the other cheek and said, okay, now strike this one, you were inviting them to, in a passive, nonviolent way, you were inviting them to engage in a behavior that would lose them their citizenship, that would bring down the Roman rule. Similarly, if a Roman told you to carry something for 1 mile and you said, fine, I'll carry it for the second mile, or I'm going to carry it for the second mile anyway, that whole second mile, that Roman is sweating bullets that nobody sees because he's now violated the law. He could lose his citizenship. Or it could start a rebellion if people thought that he had ordered it. Similarly, if the Roman says, okay, give me your coat so that you go out and work in your tunic and your cloak during the day, and say, no, I'm going to give you both. Now I'm naked. Everybody would think that the Roman had violated the law. It could start a rebellion. So it's in, those of you who've, read that part of the Bible, Jesus said, if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, and he specifies the cheek, means with the left hand. Somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn to them the other one. Somebody makes you walk a mile or carry something from, go a second mile. Somebody takes your cloak, give them your tunic as well. This is the same stuff that Gandhi did. The British had a law that said that you couldn't, if you were an Indian, you could pick cotton and you could send it to India, and you could buy clothes from India, but you couldn't spin that cotton into cloth and make your own clothes in India. So Gandhi used the spinning wheel as his logo, and they made their own clothes. The British had a law that said that you couldn't, that only the British could get salt from the ocean to ship to England and ship around the world. For that matter, to sell to Indians within India. Gandhi led a protest where they simply made their own salt. It's like passive resistance. It's not becoming the enemy, but it is actively resisting the enemy. That's what Cindy Sheehan is doing right now. It's what the Democratic Party has not figured out. The Democratic Party has not, it's pretty clear, they're pretty clear that they're not going to become like the Republicans. They're not going to go wetico. They're not going to engage in the sickness. But they haven't yet figured out, they haven't taken the lessons of Jesus and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, the same thing. Martin Luther King, they had, the laws, you can't eat in this restaurant, you can't go in this place, you can't walk on this street, we'll turn the fire hoses on you, we'll turn the dogs on you. Martin Luther King, we're going to walk down that street. We're going to step into this restaurant and sit at this lunch counter. And the world saw the brutality. Just like if during Jesus' time there had been a wholesale movement of people turning the other cheek and walking the second mile and giving up their cloaks and standing naked, there would have been a wholesale overthrow of the government, of the Roman government. And maybe there was. Keep in mind, it was 300 years later, 333, I think, the Second Council of Constantinople, that the followers of Jesus took over the Roman Empire, which is why it's now called the Holy Roman Empire, or also known as the Catholic Church. So, in any case, my point is that I think the Democrats would do well to learn a little bit from history about the power of nonviolent resistance. It's like Cindy Sheehan and her friends yesterday when that guy was firing the shots on his ranch. He says he's cleaning his gun, he's getting ready for dove hunting season. And they said, well, might there be something else at work? And he says, well, you figure it out. This is Texas. And so then, a local right-wing talk show host organizes a bunch of yahoos to go down and harass Cindy Sheehan, and then another national talk show host decides to get in on the act, and he's down there too. So you got a couple of right-wingers, hate radio guys down there. And they show up, and, you know, they're going to drive by and honk and scream obscenities and things at Cindy Sheehan. What does Cindy do? She and her friends start singing God Bless America. They're singing God Bless America. A woman who was a Sunday school teacher in a Catholic church for 8 years, singing God Bless America. And what do these right-wingers do? They start screaming, we don't care. Yeah. It's true. So Cindy Sheehan is the example for all of us, I'm telling you. Thomas Jefferson would have stood with Cindy Sheehan. He absolutely would have stood with her. But the Democrats, you know, is there going to be a Democrat standing with her? Time will tell. In fact, I just wrote a piece about this on commondreams.org. You can find it if you go to commondreams.org. It's called Jefferson Would Have Stood with Cindy Sheehan. 1-866-889-8894. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. It's so ironic you're talking about this. The thoughts after my own heart, to be frank with you. This is exactly what I believe would happen in the last election for the most part. Just how you basically described it. But may I add another thought if I can?
Sure.
I think wealth has become so entrenched that it's different in these last two elections. That wealth undermines democracy.
Yeah, well, there's
extreme
concentrations of wealth undermine democracy. Certainly, I mean Thomas Jefferson pointed that.
Now, in the context of that, if people believe and can agree that this entrenched wealth, as me and you do, undermines the process, if you will, then what you have just explained dovetails exactly that. You follow my thinking?
Sure, sure. And extreme go ahead.
I'm sorry. And this translates into the lousy two counties in Ohio that George B. Bush won this election. Two counties in Ohio beat John Kerry. And I agree. I think Bob Shrum, and all due respect to Mr. Shrum, he was the wrong man at the wrong time in the election process.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't have brought him on either.
He blew it with Gore as well. I mean, he blew it with Gore as well. He was not willing to fight hard, and it's different from fighting dirty.
That's what you brought up today, and I'm going to say it again. I believe where we're at today in 2005 is the difference between what we need to do in the next election process. The American people, unfortunately, right or wrongly, they do not respect softness.
Yeah.
In the context of what you
but
just
see, there's
described.
A difference between being righteously hard, like Cindy
yes.
Sheehan is being,
yes.
and fighting dirty. If, for example, when the Swift Boat lies had come out in the first place,
yes.
Kerry had ignored Bob Shrum's advice because Shrum just thought it would go away, that they would be that the,
yeah.
the lies were so obvious.
We had to take it to them.
Yeah, that the American people would get it and they would go away. And Shrum said, just ignore it, and that's
but
what Kerry did. And that's right. You've got to
but
say.
But they don't because.
I know. And that's the whole point. Kerry should have said these guys are liars.
God bless them. They're on their merry way every day of the week. And all I want. It reminds me of this saying. Please forgive me. I didn't mean to interrupt you. But being Italian, I lose my memory process, if you will.
We all have ADD here, Gary.
Pardon me?
We all have ADD here, Gary. This is America.
I read something that I thought was very fascinating. I'll let you go. I'll let other
sure.
callers, sometimes I get a long wind that I don't mean to be. But I'm trying to remember the quote. Oh, it said, it's not enough to be busy. So are the ants. The real question is, what are we busy about?
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Gary, thanks a lot
Thank
for the
you.
Call. Yeah, it's good to hear from you. And as I said, you can read my latest piece on this at commondreams.org. It's just and it's about how Thomas Jefferson would have stood with Cindy Sheehan, how what's going on right now with the coup, and I use that word advisedly, to take over American democracy, the attempts by concentrated wealth and power to use lies, war lies specifically, to co-opt American democracy and blow a hole in the Constitution by doing away with civil liberties and civil rights, that has happened before in the United States. That it's happened in small ways before with the Gulf of Tonkin lies of Lyndon Johnson, the USS Maine lies of McKinley, but it happened in a big way before. In the late 1790s, when John Adams, the second president of the United States, John Adams, claimed that the XYZ affair in France was such a threat to the United States, that Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z were so corrupting to us, such an insult to us, that to preserve our manly honor, we should attack France. Or that France was preparing to attack us at any minute, and we needed to prepare. And so everybody needed to circle the wagons around the president, and therefore we had to have the Alien Sedition Acts so that John Adams could put newspaper editors and publishers in jail who disagreed with him because the nation needed to speak with one voice. And Thomas Jefferson, who was vice president at the time, not because he ran together with Adams, this was before the Constitution was changed. Back then, whoever got the second largest number of votes became vice president. He ran against Adams. Thomas Jefferson left town the day that the Alien and Sedition Acts were signed, said, no, I will not stand with this. I will not have anything to do with this. This is wrong. And fought Adams tooth and nail all the way up until the election of 1800, which Jefferson won. And that was what brought democracy back to the United States. Thomas Jefferson, the man who founded the Democratic Party. Today's Democratic Party. And I got to tell you, they're not talking about Thomas Jefferson enough. And you got the Republicans, you got Republican historians out there smearing Jefferson and trying to rehabilitate the reputation of John Adams. These guys are all about their rewriting history. I mean, it's incredible. 10 minutes before they are.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
There is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that's the United States, when it suits our interests.
Well, if you want somebody who will kiss us, and someone who will kick down, one who disregards facts and contradicts his opinions, and whose mustache makes him look like a foxhound lord, John Bolton is the man to send to town.
Yeah, John Bolton, the man to send his hand, and unfortunately we've got him. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Skip in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Skip, how you doing today? What's up?
Okay, Tom, I don't know. I don't know if I remember this clearly or not, but I distinctly remember something about Gingrich making a statement back in the 80s about how the GOP had to get nasty. Do you remember that? Or
I don't remember the specifics of it, but sure. Yeah, and this is... I mean, really, this goes back to the days of Reagan, to the Lee Atwater. You know, Lee Atwater's take no prisoners politics, the politics of personal destruction. I mean, he coined that phrase, I believe. And, you know, it's sad and ironic that on his deathbed, as Lee Atwater lay dying of brain cancer, he said, please, please accept my forgiveness for what I did. He said that to Michael Dukakis and to the American people and to the Republican politicians. He said, please don't continue down this road that I had charted out. But his disciple, Karl Rove, has very much continued down that road, and America is much the worse for it.
Oh, yeah, much more so. Yeah, and I, Dukakis, you just reminded me of that. Yeah, I was really pretty infuriated with his campaign manager, how he just didn't do anything about it.
Well, they made the exact same mistake, and it may well have been Bob Schrum who was managing Dukakis' campaign, too. I mean, he's been managing Democratic presidential campaigns for a long time, and they made the exact same mistake they made with Kerry, and that was here's an ad that is outrageous, and rather than screaming and yelling, because they thought, oh, that'll draw attention to the ad, not realizing everybody's seeing the ad, sorry, these guys are putting millions of dollars behind it, and they got an entire right-wing talk machine and all the corporate media out there. They said, oh, we'll ignore it and it'll go away. And I'm sorry, it didn't go away and it won't go away and it doesn't go away. If you get hit in a dirty fashion, you need to speak out and you need to speak the truth. It doesn't mean you hit back in a dirty fashion. It means you speak out and you speak the truth. And that's what the Democrats have been unwilling to do. They've been afraid to do it. Howard Dean finally, you know, spoke out this weekend on Face the Nation. And I thought it was just so great. You know, Howard Dean finally, you know, speaking up and just speaking out. I just, you know, there you go. And saying what needed to be said.
He asked her to give up her son. She did give up her son. There's been many American women and men who've lost their lives. And we're trying to understand for what. Today, also in your paper, there was an article that said that
The troops still don't have the proper equipment. What are these people doing that are running the armed forces?
So, you know, Howard Dean this weekend, speaking truth to power. Go, Howard! I'm Tom Hartman. I'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Tag, you're it!
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.